You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we're going to talk about everybody's favorite, or for some people, maybe least favorite topic to talk about, themselves. Specifically, is the person you are now the same person you were a year ago, pre-pandemic, 10 years ago, as a kid? Or do you feel like you are someone different now? And you look back and there's a different person then. Turns out that a lot of people feel one way, a lot the other, and that could have an influence on how we grow and develop as people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have observations you could share of yourself or maybe kids or other loved ones and you've seen change over time? Do you look back and see your story as one continuous path or a whole bunch of different chapters or maybe sequels along the way? Do you think about this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Joshua Rothman is ideas editor and writer for The New Yorker. He recently wrote a piece exploring our changing identities. Joshua, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to go down the road of what led you into this. And if I'm reading it right, it started with you looking at your own kid and thinking back on your own childhood. How did that take you into this exploration of identity?
Yeah. So I have a son, he's 4.5, and he has a big personality. And, you know, it's natural to wonder, is that going to be his personality forever? What's the future going to hold? And I was around the dinner table with, you know, my son, my wife, my in-laws. And we got to talking, and one thing that really struck me was people have really, really different views about whether they've changed a lot or whether they've always been the same person their whole lives. Like, they hold very, very strong opinions about this and really divergent opinions. Some people feel very strongly that the person they are at age, let's say 45, is the same person they were when they were 5. Other people feel that they've changed once, twice, maybe many times, that they've had lots of turning points, and that, you know, maybe they're almost like unrecognizable, the person that they are now versus who they once were. I just thought that was so fascinating, and I wanted to write about it.
Yeah, what is it, or what do we know about what makes one person I think you use the words a continuer or a divider as they look back on their life story?
Well, you know, one thing that has struck me in talking, to write this article, I talked to a lot of people and I just asked them the question we're talking about. And, you know, people have really different views, but the views they have, you know, they're part of a story that has to do with the kind of person they want to be, the values they want to have. Some people are sort of loyal to themselves, if you know what I mean. They value their own consistency through time. They see that as a virtue. Other people who are dividers, they feel they've changed a lot. Like, they value the fact that they're growing and changing, that they're open to new things. Or maybe there are really important experiences that they feel are part of them and that serve as dividing lines in their lives. Or maybe they want to change now. Maybe they want to be dynamic now. And so when they look back on their lives, they emphasize how they've changed. I think, you know, part of it is just our own intuitions, our own personalities. And part of it is that, you know, what we think about what's led us to the present has bearing on what we think will happen to us in the future and the type of person that we plan to be in the future.
Talking to Joshua Rothman with New Yorker about a piece he wrote on how we think of our identities. Are we the same person from our childhood through our adult years? Is it a continuous story? Or are we different people at different stages? You ask different people, you get a different answer to that question. You can share your answer, your experience, your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Max is with us in Green Bay. Max, hi.
Hi. So I called because, you know, I heard you say, you know, how have you changed in the past year or pre-pandemic or 10 years? And I can honestly say in the past 4 months, I have changed a lot. We welcomed our baby girl into the world on November 5th, and boy, has my life changed. For the better, I'd like to add, but I just, the things that, you know, suddenly you care about if a onesie has two zippers on it, or when you hear that first giggle or see that first smile, you just melt. Or I was lucky enough to stay at home with my daughter for the first 3 months, just watching her grow and develop every day. And then the longing I experience of, you know, driving truck for 12 hours a day and not being able to see her. It's just something I never thought I'd experience myself, but here we are.
I absolutely hear you, Max. Same thing, you know, when I first had kids a little longer ago, I got to say. But do you feel like, okay, Max the dad is a different dude than Max the pre-dad? Or is it like you're a dad now, but you were set up by your experiences coming in? It's a weird, subtle question. Does it make sense to you?
Yes, it does. I feel as if I'm maybe not a whole different person, but I am definitely Max the dad now. Sometimes it's kind of hard to relate to a couple of my friends who aren't parents, because like you just find yourself going on and on about like what my daughter did today or how she's developing. But I don't feel like I'm a completely different person, I guess. I hope that was the proper response and I'm not just going on and on.
Oh, that's fine. There isn't a right answer, I think, is the answer. Joshua, that the idea that we have different chapters in our lives, one really easy chapter is being a parent all of a sudden. Do you see people looking at that as a common dividing point in their different identities in their lives?
Yeah, parenthood is definitely a big one, a big chapter divider, or you know, to use a TV metaphor, it's like season one, season two, season three, you know, like season three might be you become a parent. But there are lots of other dividing lines that that some people feel really separate their lives into sections, moving to a new country, becoming an immigrant, that's a really big one. Doing things like going to war, having, you know, traumatic, challenging, kind of transformative experiences, that's a big one. I talked to one person who was a doctor. She'd worked in sort of a fancy hospital for a long period of time, and then she worked in a hospital that was in an economically, you know, deprived area where the patients were totally different, the challenges were totally different. She felt like that was too sort of portions of her life. And so there's lots of different, you know, events that can be boundaries. And, you know, one question which has come up in this conversation is, you know, can your life change and you remain the same, but your life has chapters, but you're still the same dude, the same personality, the same things, you know, the same disposition reacting to all these changes? Or have these changes changed you in some deeper way, where, you know, when you look in the mirror, there's a different person looking back? People have different feelings about that.
Max, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Joshua, before we go back to our callers, you know, a lot of this feels kind of philosophical and personal, but some psychologists have tried to study this, and you look closely at this study, a big study in New Zealand. Can you tell us about this?
It's a fascinating study. So, you know, it's what's called a prospective study, which is to say, it's not talking to people who are grown and asking them, what were you like as a kid? Have you changed? It's following people from when they were born over decades and trying to see if they've remained consistent or if they've changed in different ways. And basically what the researchers find after following people for, you know, well, I think it's more than four decades through their lives, is that some types of character traits are more persistent than others. So some of us don't change in very specific ways because of who we are. And essentially what they find is, you know, if you imagine a big group of, you know, 100 kids, 100 elementary school kids, they're all different. They all have different traits. You know, some are really courageous, some are really social, some are really funny, some are really, you know, whatever. But there's two traits that are persistent through time. One is being what they call inhibited, but I think it really just means keeping to yourself, you know, being self-contained. People who are self-contained when they're small continue to be self-contained into adulthood. And the other is being sort of adversarial. They call it moving against the world, being a person who is prone to conflict. And both of those things persist in part because if you're a person who keeps to yourself, you kind of create a social niche for yourself, where, you know, not that much is going to come in and change that. If you're sort of a person who has struggled to get along with other people, that's persistent because it's sort of self-reinforcing, you know. And those are two traits that, you know, statistically, so not, it's not determinative, but statistically they tend to sort of persist, you know. But things can change them. Having a marriage, a romantic partner, a mentor, having a close relationship with someone can change the dynamics there and sort of cause a reset in some ways. So, you know, it's a fascinating study that shows that, you know, although to some extent all of our personality traits, you know, are consistent through our lives, there are some traits that kind of have more sticking power than others. And it can kind of isolate them by looking at all those people through time.
We're talking to Joshua Rothman, ideas editor at The New Yorker, about whether who we are as individuals stays the same over time or if it can and actually does change through the years. You can join in with your thoughts on that question at 800-642-1234. When you look back in your life, do you see it as one consistent story where you're basically the same person through it, or is it really separate chapters where you're a different person at different stages? No wrong answer to that question. A lot of people answer one way or the other. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Joshua Rothman, ideas editor and writer at The New Yorker, talking about a piece he wrote called "Are You the Same Person You Used to Be?" Looking at questions of identity, personality, if we're the same person all along or different people at different stages of our lives, if we can change ourselves significantly on purpose. You can join in with your answers at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I love talking about this. I had like a philosophical awakening in college. Soren Kierkegaard was my favorite philosopher, and I had this self-awareness that as I grew up, every decade, I had a new opportunity, new challenges. And I got to tell you, I thought I was Brad Pitt in my 20s and Tom Cruise in my 30s and then Tom Hanks and then probably Jerry Seinfeld. And now I think I'm Charlton Heston. Do you think the media influences who we are because of the time we live in?
Oh, interesting. Jeff, thanks a lot for that. You know, so pop culture definitely offers us a lot of models to define our identity and define our life stories. Do you see that, Joshua?
I love that. I love that list of actors. they sound like pretty good. I bet you're not the only one who has that, those desires to be those guys. It's a great question. You know, how much does the world we grew up in sort of determine who we are? You know, talk to some people, for example, who, you know, they were in their 20s in the 1960s, and during that time they were politically incredibly liberal. They were hippies. They had a whole way of life that was related to the 60s. They were swept up in a culture at that time, and then a couple decades later they find, you know, their politics have changed, their whole lifestyle has changed. And when you look at photos of a couple decades before, it's like you can't even recognize that person. You know, like my dad, if you look at photos of him in the 70s, he has crazy hair and he's into all sorts of crazy jazz and he's like this really far out guy. I have siblings who are a lot younger than me, and you know, I remember that version of my dad that existed when he was you know, a far out guy, and they only know the older version of my dad, who's the most straight-laced person ever. And that question of, you know, have you changed because the times have changed, is a great question. And one thing it speaks to is how in certain ways we're really malleable, and the things we're interested in are sort of, they're part of the times. Now, is there a core of you that stayed the same, you know, that was interested in Kierkegaard when you were young and, you know, still now is? There very well might be. So one question you can, you know, that I think a lot of people find themselves thinking about when they explore this is, what parts of me are changeable and what parts of me are durable? And you know, maybe you have a heterogeneous kind of identity with certain things being, you know, very dynamic and other things being, you know, very, very consistent through time.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Tony joins us now in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hi.
Hi, guys. I'm under the column of I'm the same person I've always been, which was very impetuous and very inquisitive. A 67-year-old guy who read a book called Your Table is Ready about a New York maitre d', and I just became a waiter for the first time in my life at a fine Italian restaurant in Sturgeon Bay, and I know nothing about waiting tables. I've been doing it a month, and it's the most terrifying thing I've ever done. but I've always challenged myself. And in the beginning, it's always pure terror until I figure it out. So I like who I am. And as Popeye said, I am what I am.
Tony, great Popeye quote to sum up that continuer thing. Tony, impetuous and inquisitive all his life, and he's sticking with it, Joshua. He's definitely on that continuer side of the equation.
You know, I think a lot of people, some people have the the experience of knowing they're continuers. But sometimes it's a thing people discover, which is kind of interesting. Like, you thought you were changing, you know, you thought things were really up in the air. And then when you reach a certain point in your life, you sort of decide who that you accept who you've always been. That's a formulation that comes up. One guy I talked to for this piece, he described having a life that he thought was very changeable, but then one day discovering like an old journal in which he'd written a bunch of short stories. And at that time that he was older, he, you know, retired and he was trying his hand at writing fiction. And then he went back and looked at these old stories and saw they were exactly the same. So, you know, the reality, as it were, of being a continuer is something people sometimes just discover.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tony. If I swing by Sturgeon Bay, I'll try to track down your restaurant. I'm a pretty mellow customer, so don't worry. We are talking about who we are, our identity, how it changes, if it changes over time, with Joshua Rothman at The New Yorker. Back to your calls now. Ben is on the line in Watertown. Ben, hi.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm a fan of this British documentary, 7-Up, and the 7-Up series. I don't know if the expert you have there is familiar with it, but pretty much these young people at 7 years old, year 1956, I think, 58, had an idea of what they wanted to be, whether it be a lower-class young man wanted to be a jockey, an upper-class boy going to a private school already knew he wanted to be a barrister. One of the other young women said, I'm going to be working at Woolworths. And, you know, the story follows them every 7 years from right. Age 7, 14, 21, et cetera. You know, what they thought of themselves, they didn't always succeed. But they had their track set for them at age 7. It's pretty interesting.
Ben, thanks a lot. And Joshua, this is one of your data points, this documentary that followed people, as Ben said, age 7, 14, 21, 28. What did you take away from that on this question of how we change or stay the same?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, yeah, it's an incredible documentary series. I can't recommend it enough. And it's absolutely fantastic. One of the things that... you know, it's a really interesting thing because it's a project that's a lifetime's worth of work for a team of filmmakers. And when they made the first one, I think they had, my understanding is they had a pretty clear idea of sort of what they were aiming to show, which was how much our economic circumstances when we're young shape the course of our lives. And sure enough, I think they did find exactly what you're describing, Ben, that over the course of life, you know, where you started turns out to shape a lot of where you end up. And, you know, especially these early things about careers, about parents, you know, to some degree about nepotism in some cases, they kind of shape things. But then what I think strikes me when I watch that series too, is how there are certain aspects of people's lives that you never could have anticipated. Like, you know, one guy moves to Australia. Like, you know, he wasn't expecting to do that, but that's what happens. Someone else gets really involved in fostering kids. That's like a big surprise, in helping orphan kids. Mm-hmm. You know, someone else becomes a nuclear physicist. That's like a big surprise. So one of the things that's interesting about that series is, you know, in a way, the question of whether you change through life, it kind of encourages you to think in generalities about yourself. To say, well, I've always been outgoing. I was outgoing when I was small and I'm outgoing now. I guess I'm the same person. But a lot of the things that really matter to us in our lives are really specific. I mean, they're, you know, when you think about like giving a eulogy for someone, what are the things you talk about? Well, you do say, you know, she was always kind. You know, she loved her family. But you also note that, you know, she was a huge Eagles fan or, you know, that her favorite band was, you know, the Grateful Dead or whatever, it matters. All that specific stuff matters. And there's a way where you know, those developments in your life that you can say, you know, well, it was a certain age when I discovered something I loved forever, like watercolor painting, made a big difference in my life. That's a big part of who I am. It's unexpected, and it's a big change, and it's possible to sort of discount it in this conversation. But also maybe those things really define who we are, and they can be really consistent and really changeable too.
Ben, thanks for that call. Fun fact, one of those 7-Up kids grew up to be an engineering professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I interviewed him on the show a few years back. Now, Joshua, we just have a minute left. Why is it worth contemplating these questions?
Well, I think the simple truth is, you know, as you said, there's no right answer here. And there might not even be a permanent answer for each one of us. This might be something that we're constantly changing our minds about. And that's just because we're always looking back on our lives. We're always trying to understand who we are and where we're going. And, you know, we can one day think or emphasize in our thoughts our own consistency, and the next day emphasize our own changeability. And I think it's worth thinking about this stuff in part because sometimes you just have a way of thinking about your identity. And just by even having this conversation, you can start to see that there are other ways to think about it. That maybe, you know, you've always told yourself that you've always been the same, but you might just say, what would my life look like if I thought about it from the other perspective and looked for ways in which I've changed, and vice versa. You know, I think the more imaginative and creative you can be in thinking about your story, you know, the more opportunities for meaning you can find in your own life.
Joshua, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Joshua Rothman, ideas editor at The New Yorker. We talked to him about personality and identity, who we are and whether and how that can change over time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the UW system president says it's time for an in-state tuition increase after years of a freeze. We'll find out why. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we get an in-depth update on the rapid growth of the electric battery industry. From lithium mines to the production line, we'll look at the affordability, the effectiveness, and the safety of lithium-ion batteries, plus other alternatives on the market. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new grant aims to decrease mental health disparities in Wisconsin. We'll hear from three groups working with that program about what mental health disparities look like here in the state and how the grant money could help. First, electric batteries are a huge part of plans to move toward a renewable energy future and away from fossil fuels. As production continues to ramp up, the costs have been trending down. Because batteries are the most expensive component of electric vehicles, the Wall Street Journal reports that the gap is starting to close between the costs of EVs and their gas-powered counterparts. We have seen, though, some bottlenecks in battery production. Part of the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act creates incentives to increase domestic lithium extraction and processing for lithium-ion batteries. And last week, Tesla announced their plans to develop domestic lithium refining capacity for their vehicles. There have been other growing pains. For example, Ford temporarily stopped production of their F-150 Lightning electric pickup truck to address concerns about potential battery fires. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the constantly evolving battery world, the technology, the production, and more? What do you want to know about your electric vehicle if you have one? What concerns do you have about battery safety? Do you want to see more focus on production here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steve Levine is the editor of the Electric Newsletter. That's part of the online technology publication, The Information. He's author of the book, The Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Now, I first talked to you back in 2015, and there were a lot of open questions about whether battery technology was going to keep up with our need, our goals of electrifying lots of stuff. What do you see as the biggest big picture stories over that last, 8 years?
Okay, the first thing I want to say is I'm mad at you for not speaking to me for 8 years. So when we spoke back then, it was right when the powerhouse was coming out, and batteries, EVs, this future was was pretty aspirational. You know, we thought that it was possible that the price, the cost of batteries would come down enough to make EVs one day competitive with combustion. But they were still very expensive, and it was we had Tesla out there with a Tesla S. So the big thing that has changed is very, very in very quick order, really over the last 2 or 3 years, the price, the cost of batteries has plummeted, and EVs themselves have become cheaper. All of the major automakers in the world, without exception, have bought into the Tesla story. They all want to be Tesla. So we're embarking on a world flooded by EVs. And so the difference, in short, is we are in an electric world.
What is driving the price of these batteries down over this last couple of years?
Iteration, you know, so very surprisingly, you know, you tinker year by year, and you get a few single percentage points off the cost every year for 10 or 12 years, and suddenly you've gone down an order of magnitude. So in 2010, the metric we're talking about is dollars per kilowatt hour for batteries, and around 2010, when this whole age began, it was about $1,000 or $1,200, and it's like $120 or $150 now. So it is an order of magnitude lower, but that's really, Rob, it's just cutting out, say, 5 to 7% per year of the cost by tinkering.
We've thought a lot about supply chains for various products over the last few years. How central is China to the electric battery supply chain, whether it's the raw materials, things like lithium and other minerals, versus, and of course, the production of the batteries themselves?
Yeah. So the short answer is that China totally dominates the battery supply chain. And that doesn't mean the ore. So the ore, most of the ore comes from other places like Democratic Republic of Congo, the Lithium Triangle countries in South America, Australia, Indonesia. But what China controls is everything that happens after that. So processing all of those metals into precursor chemicals, and then turning those into electrodes and separators and so on, and making those into batteries, and then making they're also making big inroads in EVs themselves. So the Chinese, we started out on an even playing field back in 2009, 2010. The U.S. and China both said they were going to own EVs. They were both going to own batteries. We quit around 2012. The Chinese kept going, and the result of that is they own the battery space.
Now, the Biden administration, I mentioned, is trying to push production here in the United States. Is it too late, or is there room for a game of catch-up there?
It's too late for the 2020s. So the Chinese will own the 2020s.
We're talking to Steve Levine, editor of the Electric Newsletter, author of the book The Powerhouse: America, China, and the Great Battery War. We're talking about the latest developments in batteries for electric vehicles and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to our guest in a few minutes. I've lost our connection, I believe. But again, you can join in. Do you have an electric vehicle yourself? Love to hear from you. What made you decide? How did the cost shake out when you were comparison shopping, maybe with gas vehicles or hybrids? You can email ideas@WPR.org or call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Steve Levine, editor of the Electric Newsletter. That's part of the online technology publication, The Information. He's the author of The Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War, talking about the growing electric battery industry, cost, supply chain challenges, some safety concerns. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, before we go to our callers, before the break, you were just talking about China owning the 2020s, at least when it comes to battery production. Is there room, if we start now, for the United States to move in after that?
Yeah. Rob, can I ask you where we dropped off?
You actually made a pretty strong statement. China owns the 2020s, and that's where we lost you.
And that's okay. So I'll just very quickly wrap up the rest. It's so you know, China spent the 2010s buying and leasing and signing contracts for all of the lithium metals that they needed around the world, and establishing in China the whole industry from soup to nuts, from the chemicals to the electrodes to batteries themselves. And right now you can almost not make a lithium.
And we've lost the connection with our guest again. We will just go with an old-fashioned phone call next. And you can make an old-fashioned phone call at 800-642-1234 as we hopefully pick up the conversation about electric batteries and their future in the United States. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, we'll take a look at mental health disparities here in Wisconsin. Check in with a few people working on a new grant program. Okay, we got you back again, Steve. I think we'll stick with this line for now. Pick up where you left off. The China soaked up a lot of the lithium around the world, you were saying. Can we get more of it?
Yeah. So China really has all of the metals, the cobalt, nickel, manganese, lithium, and also the graphite. They can control the graphite. And so the United States is embarked on trying to establish its own processing industry. That is the strategic center, is being able to process everything into electrodes. This is what the money is all about, right? The U.S., it's an unprecedented effort by the U.S. in a peacetime effort. $250 billion to jumpstart a battery industry in the United States, and it's all about execution. We have a terrible history of sticking with things. So I mean, right now we're in a very good position. It's a very impressive effort that Congress and the administration have put together, but it has to be something that's sustained for the whole decade.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hi. There's a quick comment. The chairman of Toyota has decided that plug-in hybrids still have a place in America's future, because in 100% electric battery is only good when the grid is up, and we're having a lot of problems with a fragile grid. But the other point is, there is a new design for lead acid, and lead acid batteries, because of their weight, makes better for stationary batteries like backup systems. And it's called a green lead acid, which is made by a company in Michigan, ABC Battery or Advanced Battery, and it's half the battery weight, twice the charge time, or half the charge time, twice the charge length, and it's got a niche to play. So I think the 100% electric lithium is not the solution. And as Toyota chairman said, there's still going to be people who can't afford $70,000-$80,000 electrics and plug-in hybrids.
Mike, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. A couple points there, Steve. Now, Toyota's, that exec you're talking about, was one of the great, I think, skeptics in the auto industry, kind of a standout in skepticism about electric vehicles. What do you make of Toyota and EVs?
Yeah, I think that Toyota is right. One, you should know that Toyota has... they've pivoted to electrics to some degree, right? So the CEO was just demoted, elevated, and a new CEO brought in, and the new CEO, the reason for that was to make the pivot to EVs. But what's their point? Their point is that it's really the point that I'm making, that the transition to a non-Chinese future, to creating the battery supply chain and capacity around the world is going to take, the next 8 or 10 years. What do we do in the meantime? And Toyota is arguing that there are going to be people who, they'll pay for, the more expensive EVs now, but there are going to be a lot of people who don't want to pay less or have different preferences, and the hybrid is the answer for them. What's wrong with that? I don't understand why anyone would object to that. And the second thing the caller was asking about lead acid batteries,
right.
He was talking about stationary batteries, and yes, absolutely. You've got all the space in the world. Weight doesn't matter. So, lead acid is cheap. So why not use lead acid? Absolutely.
And that would be, thanks a lot for that call. Would that be, you said stationary. So something like, hey, we're generating tons of wind or solar power right now. We want to store it for, overnight or something like that when we need it. Is that a place where a stationary lead acid battery might come into the picture?
That's exactly where it would.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go down to Jim with us in East Troy. Jim, hi.
Hi. Say, so I've just got a question on the future of this. So lithium has its limitations. NiCad batteries are kind of gone. Lead acid has its limitations. What's coming down the pipe? What's the next thing in storage?
Oh, interesting, yeah. Jim. Steve, that's something you've been looking at, the next thing in storage for years now. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, okay. So the first thing to know, right, is keeping in mind the context. Lead acid invented in 1869. So it's been with us a long time. That's how long these sort of technologies endure. And lithium is going to be with us. Lithium ion batteries for a very long time. I don't know if it's going to be 150 years like with lead acid, but a long time. And there are physical, there are chemical reasons for that. What is next on the radar screen that could coexist with it? There's sodium ion. Sodium is salt. It's everywhere. It's even more plentiful than lithium. It's less energy dense. It will give you less range, a lot less range in your car. The same sort of that carries through in terms of stationary storage. Less longevity, but again, it's cheap, it's plentiful, and so if there is at this stage. If there is going to be a successor to lithium, it would be sodium.
Thanks a lot for that call. Now, I wanted to ask, one of the things we noticed out there that prompted us to want to have the conversation, we're seeing some reports of concerns of fire. I mentioned the Ford F-150 electric stop production for a bit over fire concerns. We see stories on airplanes where people's devices start smoking with lithium batteries. I think New York has concerns about electric bikes. So, is this happening a lot, or are we in the media focusing on this so it looks like it's happening a lot? How big a concern is this?
I think it is a concern. It doesn't mean that it's happening more than it has in the past, but I think that that the novelty of electric cars is going to wear off, you know, the wow factor, and people are going to zero in. Okay, what are the flaws? What are the shortcomings? One of the shortcomings of the dominant chemistry, which is a nickel-based chemistry, lithium, remember, is just the repository of the energy. That's what shuttles in, back and forth within the battery. But the electrodes are made of something else, graphite on one side, and then usually a nickel-based electrode on the other side. That electrode is flammable, I mean, extremely, extremely volatile. And so there's another formulation that uses iron and phosphate, LFP. It's called. It's a lot less flammable. And I think because of the safety concerns that we are going to see a dramatic shift to this much less flammable electrode.
Let's go now to Marty with us in Palmyra. Marty, hello.
Hello. Question. So when these lithium batteries wear out, then what do we do with them? We bury them in a mountain, or can you recycle them, or what?
The end of the lifespan, Steve, for these lithium, especially these lithium electric vehicle batteries. What do we know about that at this point?
Yeah. So this is a it's a cottage industry. So there are a lot of people thinking about that. There are a handful already of companies, including listed companies. Li-Cycle is one of them. That have developed recycling technologies, and so the short answer is that almost everything in a lithium ion battery can be recycled, and there are companies doing it, and the auto companies themselves are trying to arrange for this to happen. And one big reason for this is what you stated in the beginning, and that's the shortage of the metals. Where are we going to get all the metals that we need? And so if you can create a circular kind of effect, that'll be good. However, I just wanted to add at the end here, we're at the very beginning of the of a critical mass of EVs being produced and sold on the market. These cars are going to last. The batteries within the cars and the cars themselves are going to last 15 years. I mean, they're lasting a lot longer than people thought, and that means that the bulk of the recycling that you're thinking of is way into the 2030s. That's when it'll begin.
And Steve, just in our last minute, what is the big question you're asking right now about what's next for these batteries?
Well, I guess my big question is, I guess I would repeat what I already said, is do we as Americans have the stick-to-itness to stick with the creation of this new industry for, you know, the 10 years that it'll take to complete the job?
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Steve Levine, editor of The Electric Newsletter. He's also author of the book, The Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War. He joined us today with the latest on the electric battery industry, China's current control of the production market, and the Biden administration's push for more domestic production, and some concerns about battery effectiveness and safety. You could still keep sharing your experiences if you've shopped for or bought an electric car, what you think about how they're working for you, or why you decided not to go that way. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from three organizations in Wisconsin that were recently given state grant funding, to help decrease mental health disparities in the state. And you can join us, as always, maybe with your own experiences seeking mental health care in your community. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.